emotional, transforming, musical, linguistic object.
Greetings from Cyberdelic Space. This is Lorenzo, and I'm your host here in the Psychedelic Salon. Well, today's program is a talk that Sasha Shulgin gave at the Jamaica Mind States Conference in 2002. I'd like to think that everyone who hears this podcast already knows a lot about Sasha, but if you don't, then you owe it to yourself to go to Arrowhead or Wikipedia or just anywhere on the net and look him up. In my humble opinion, he's the world's greatest chemist, and in a perfect world, he'd already have his Nobel Prize. What do I base that over-the-top statement on, you ask? Well, just pick up a copy of P-Call and T-Call, two books that he and his wife Anne wrote, and check out the chemical stories that make up the second half of each book. There you're not only going to find a listing of, well over 200 phenethylamines and tryptamines that he synthesized, most of which I believe had never been built before Sasha did it, but synthesizing these compounds wasn't the first step, nor was it even the most important step, I don't think. The first step was in figuring out which ones might be psychoactive and which ones weren't, and how he does that is part of the talk that I think you're going to enjoy hearing just in a few minutes. Now, if you're not a chemist, don't worry, because he's always good about peppering the chemistry part of his lecture with all kinds of interesting little stories and anecdotes. To tell you the truth, I've always thought of Sasha's talks more as performance art pieces than lectures. Now, if you go to our podcast page at matrixmasters.com, then you'll find Sasha's name in the listing for our program 22 of the Psychedelic Salon. That's the one you're listening to right now. And click on Sasha's name, you'll be taken to a page where I posted a picture that I took of Sasha while he was giving one of his talks back in the late 90s. And I think you'll get a little idea of how animated he can get when he really gets into his topic. In fact, in the recording you're about to hear, Sasha was talking so fast at one point that Anne had to ask him to slow down a bit. And he did, for about 2 minutes or so. Since I'm not a chemistry whiz myself, whenever Sasha gets on one of his rolls about moving this atom to that ring and then flipping it over or something like that, I just pretend I'm listening to the world's greatest auctioneer. Only I know he's not selling anything. He's just waxing poetic about some of my favorite chemicals. You know, it's too bad we don't have a video of this performance. In fact, there wasn't even a professional recording service there at the time. Fortunately for us, Kevin Whitesides was there, and he had the presence of mind to turn on his tape recorder. So without any further ado, here is Sasha Shulgin talking about natural versus synthetic psychedelic compounds.
So what I want to talk about today is the synthetic side of things. It's interesting to know, there's a very good friend of mine, now dead, name of Terence McKenna. He was giving a lecture one time at Esalen. Remember that, Annie, remember that Esalen lecture Terence was about 15 years ago, 10 years ago? He was giving this long talk about the beauties of ayahuasca, the beauties of DMT, and all these natural psychedelics. And not very deeply disguised under his discussion was the fact, if it ain't natural, it probably ain't safe and not good. Which, he wouldn't say it quite that way, but he knew there was a prejudice sneaking in there about natural as opposed to synthetic. And he's commenting about these very excellent natural materials, and he's about ready to go a little bit more negative on the synthetics than the audience saw me. And he didn't want to quickly tear down my little world of synthesis, because he had dipped into it and appreciates it. But his theme of that talk was natural versus synthetic. And so I did a little snooping around. I think Jonathan was the first one to come up the actual numbers. DMT, dimethyltryptamine, which I'll get into in the, not get into in the, that sense, but get into in the lecture sense, a little later in the hour, is a good example of the conflict here, because it was first synthesized by Mansky up in Canada, roughly 1932, 33, 35, somewhere there. And it was discovered as a component of a South American plant about 20 years later by the second reporter was a research director at Bristol for a while. That's how I learned about that. But this was 20 years. It was a synthetic compound. And then it was discovered in nature. So for 20 years, from his philosophy, it's something that is not a good chemical, not a good drug. But once it was found in a tree somewhere in South America, or bush, it's okay. And there are about four or five drugs that are synthetic that have been found in nature. So the idea of keeping, why should things that are natural be safer? Because people have used them, people have used strychnine for hundreds, thousands of years. Doesn't make it safe. So you have to hold that kind of a restriction in abeyance. But anyway, I want to talk about the synthetics that have come out of studying the natural materials. The first material I ever got into, about 1950-something or other, was synthetic mescaline. It was a beautiful, I loved it, appearance, a beautiful white crystalline solid. This was the bisulfate salt, long white needles. And I took, I think it was 350 or 375 milligrams, I forget, it was either 350, 375. I was with three, four babysitters, and there were about four of us who were in the experiment, just enough to get into a car. One of the babysitters was the driver, I might assure you. And that's a good thing to keep in mind. Don't try driving a car under meth. That's immature. You know that. Anyway, it was an interesting experience. Once I got over the initial nausea, and the nausea was not that really bad. It was, I had forgotten I had eaten not that much before, but I was reminded what I had eaten when I looked at my vomit. And there it all was. I think it had chewed up peas and some carrots and odds and ends like that. And the first thing that caught my attention that I was in a strange place is I really enjoyed looking at my vomit. Now, here's out in the field, on the grass, and here's, this is part of me. It came out of me. It was, in essence, I identified with it. What in the world is going on? It was my first psychedelic experience. And that developed from there into strange, strange, fascinating areas. One, we went up to the top of the hills behind Berkeley, and one of my first close encounters with a thing in nature that I had not really ever tangled with before was a bee. And I watched this bee, it came up to a flower, and the bee kind of into this blossom, and the bee saw me and ignored me. I watched the bee, I watched the blossom, looked at the interaction, and that bee was taking stuff out of this flower and putting it something like a little sack down its leg on one side. Then into the blossom again and got some more and put it in the sack on the other side. I don't know how long this went on. It may have been 25 minutes. I was watching that bee storing stuff away. The bee, again, was aware of me and had the grace of ignoring me totally. And I watched this whole thing and it was all gone. The bee went away. I took the flower. It's a little part of the story later on. But all kinds of things. Alongside the road up there where we parked was gravel. Sort of there was a pave, but the gravel was on the side and the gravel was different colored stones. And I could not get out of the car on the passenger side because I saw that as the back of a crocodile or something nasty. And if I stepped on the back of that animal, I might not be safe. So I had to get out on the other side of the car. Visual colors. I saw colors that were totally alien to me. I used to think I knew the designation of colors. The colors that were not in. Look at a plain piece of color. And the outer edges were affected by the color of the thing that was next to it. You know, that it would be green, but when there's red over here, the green became kind of purplish to reflect the red, and the red became sort of different colors to reflect the green. And I saw the colors were not a single thing. They were a continuum of change. Fascinating. At the end of the experience, down back, I lived in Berkeley at that time, went down there, and the flower I put in a little vase on the coffee table in front of the thing, and I smelled it. It was a gorgeous smell. I was intrigued by the inside of that flower. And I looked out inside, I couldn't even touch the petals. I mean, it was a little bougies that carry pollen, and thistles, whatever they call it, in the center of it. And I looked inside, I tried to move the petals apart, so I couldn't do it. Caught my attention, the reason I mentioned the flower is my next first real synthetic experiment was with material which I had extended the chain, one carbon, to go from a phenethylamine, which is over here with a two-carbon chain. This is, by the way, takes the place of slides, takes the place of projecting things. This is the Drake effect. Anyway, I'm going to use a blackboard for drawing dirty pictures, and we compromise, and I draw a phenethylene here, and a tryptamine here, and I'll point to them as we go so I don't have to use a blackboard. And let that be it. I said, if this compound is this dramatic, and then I stopped and thought for a while, the compound wasn't doing anything. It was I who was doing everything. I was seeing the color. The compound is not the white. There's no color there at all. I went into meditation, went into deep thoughts of some early childhood things, in which I had found some pretty colored flowers out behind the house, another house in Berkeley where I lived. And I can remember that with great clarity, being out underneath the honeysuckle and watching up and watching out, and no one could see me because I was inside of the, under the fence with honeysuckle all around me. And I remember that with great clarity. And I began saying, where in the molecule that happens to have three methoxy groups over here and two carbon chain is the memory of honeysuckle? Where is the knowledge of colors? Where's all this memory? Where's the ability to watch a bee without complete, with a complete immunity? Do its honeysuckle, do its flower thing. I said, what it is, this is not a drug that's doing anything, providing me information, doing anything for me. It is allowing me to get into myself. So in essence, it is not a chemical drug, but it's a catalyst that allows me internally to find things. By luck, I may find things I want. I don't know what they're going to be, but I was totally fascinated. This was back in the 50s. And that completely changed the direction of my entire life research. I had some knack at chemistry, and I was quite interested in things that were psychoactive. I delved around in the library for this, but never really gotten to psychedelics before. And that was my very first introduction. And so, God, it was obvious. You have three, four, five trimethoxy over here. Don't worry what a methoxy is. Two carbon chain, and the amine group on this end. And that's the simplicity of the molecule. Not a very potent thing. It took a few hundred milligrams to do the job. But the job was fascinating because the job was entirely from me. Not to me, but out of me. So I said, well, by golly, what can you do there? So I said, well, there's a alpha position there, and I put a methyl group on there. And this is where chemistry on a blackboard is such fun. And people say, well, it's easy on a blackboard. When you go to the laboratory, then you can't just go and take a little nail and a hammer and take a methyl group and whack a methyl group on them. On the side of a chain. I mean, you don't do that quite that way. On a blackboard, if all chemistry were blackboard with erasers and chalk, would be simple. You could make any molecule in about 20 seconds. But the truth is, making molecules to jive with the structure is not that much more difficult. You have to think from a different point of view, but it's all there. So I moved in the laboratory, and I made the methyl group down that position, which is the amphetamine chain, carbon, 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 hanging down at the amine group, the amphetamine. And to make that an easy nitrothane, you have to have a little nitrothane, so I coupled the corresponding trimethoxybenzaldehyde. Don't worry about this, it's all in the book somewhere. Trimethoxybenzaldehyde and nitrothane, the roots of sodium hydride, and there was the corresponding amphetamine. Trimethoxyamphetamine, what's called TMH for the planet. So I looked into the chemical literature, it had been synthesized by a group of people in Canada about 3 years earlier, and they had said it had an interesting property. If you're watching a what's this wheel that whirls around and gives you color?
Kaleidoscope.
Kaleidoscope. Good. Watch a kaleidoscope and it generates colors. The colors are more intense if you take this compound first. Well, I didn't particularly want to play with a kaleidoscope, but I appreciated the fact it had colors. And so I made the compound. If you go and measure twice what they use, you get into a psychedelic place. Not nearly a mescaline, but a different thing. But meanwhile, while I was preparing that compound, I said, well, nitroethane, nitropropane, nitrobutane, I got all the nitroalkanes I had, because the one carbon indeed makes this immortal different thing. Let's add two, let's add three, let's add four, let's add five. So I synthesized about eight or nine compounds, all with different sized chains hanging down there. And by the time I had gotten the others made out here, the first one I had evaluated, it was about twice as active in potency as mescaline, but totally different in its action. It was not the friendly closeness of mescaline. It was almost an aggressive, almost something had a portrait. It revealed in me. Now, again, it's not the compound who's doing it. It's me, what is being revealed from me by the compound. And again, the parallel, I mentioned the flower at some length with mescaline, is I had a very similar flower on the coffee table in Berkeley with this. And I was curious about the smell of what's inside, and I tore it apart. Tore it apart to look inside. Completely destroying the flower. But with complete immunity, I mean, obviously, this is my thing, I want to look, I did it. So after a while, I said, why is one actually so precious that you can't destroy any part of nature, and the other you can just tear it apart because you're curious? Anyway, the third compound of the chain of 8 or 10 of them, not active at all, and it's a heck of the rest of them. So this, what else can we do in this molecule? That really got me started. If you can change an atom in a molecule, you can keep a kind of a psychoactive aspect of it. Change all the atoms. Go look around. Try this, try that, moved over here. So I looked at this one, and I think I have written over here 3-4-5. Mescaline is 3-4-5 carbonthoxy. You dangle the thing by the ring, the aromatic ring on my right, over this way, and have those methoxies down there. There are six ways you can have three methoxies in the ring. You have 2-3-4, 2-3-5, 2-3-6, 2-4-5, 2-4-6, and one other I've forgotten. 2-3-6. One is all consumed because the one is where it hangs from, honing this little thing off the Christmas tree by the dingler and telling the number of pips on the hexagons that you can attach things to. So I made all six of them. So I have TMA2, TMA3, TMA4, TMA5, TMA6. And of course, in diligence and a bit of retentiveness, assayed them all in about the same way, ran them all down. And the first one I hit was the TMA2, the one with the methoxies in the 2-4-5 positions. Has the amphetamine, alpha methyl down there. And that caught me off guard because I happened at that point to still be an employed chemist at Dow up in Walnut Creek in Pittsburgh. And I went in, I was not feeling very comfortable, but I went into a closet where they kept the things because they cleaned the floors with this little strip. No one who worked there would go in there because that's a janitor's place. No janitors during the day, so I felt fairly not discoverable in there. And I found myself going into a very, I thought I had very carefully had moved myself one small increment up of activity. Some activity, maybe at 12, I went to 20. And 20 came on very heavy and very fast, and I was into a whole new territory that was totally scary. And so I was prejudiced against that for a while, so I tried it more carefully later on. And it's about 10 times as potent as mescaline. It's a great increase in potency. And a lot of vigil, but a kind of a thing that didn't reveal a part of me that I cared that much about. But that's okay. Right then I was still counting potency rather than quality. Actually, both are very valid measures of activity. And so the TMA3 was a 2-4-5, 2-3-4, TMA4, 2-3-5, TMA5, 2-3-6, and the other one, the final one, where they're at the opposite thing, the 2-4-6. Was also potent and comparable to TMA2. So TMA2 and TMA6 were the two in there that I found to be interesting and active and worth pursuing. The whole area from that point on, this is the ethylamine world, what I did, I took that basic structure and began mucking around with it, but the TMA6 structure allows fully a comparable degree of exploration, and I've never explored it. So if anyone really wants to go into chemistry and get a whole area, start with a 2-4-6 instead of 2-4-5 and duplicate everything. You're going to find fascinating compounds, do fascinating things. Different to make. Some are more difficult, some are easier. I just haven't gotten around to that. That's kind of the thing. I mean, you start bossing out, you take this path, that path, all, and you go past thousands of paths that go out from your path here on. None of them have been explored. Who knows what's out that way? You don't know. It's like going down the corridor with 55 doors. You go through a door, there's another corridor with 55 doors. What are the other doors you can go to? You don't know. There's something out there that's interesting. If you had 55 lives, you find it out. But as it is, you pursue the one that happens to catch your fancy at the moment. And that's where I went. So, you have the methoxies out there. Well, two methoxies make two oxygens, and two oxygens are methylene dioxy. So, if you take that same molecule, 2-3-4-5-6, or did I write the 6 on there? I think I did. Yeah, down here. If you had to bridge two adjacent spots with the methylene dioxy, the two oxygens tied together with the carbon, and then put the methoxy on something that's left, you have six possibilities. So I call this MMDA, methylene dioxy, methamphetamine, methoxyamphetamine. And there's six of them possible. And I made the five that were obvious. The sixth I had no way of figuring out how to make. I tried a variety of different things, never succeeded. I'm amused because they made the methoxyamphetamine, MMDA, methoxymethanedoxyamphetamine, schedule one drug by naming one of them, and saying that all positional isomers are also included under this definition. So although I can make five, they only reported one, but the total of six are in schedule one. And I'm a little bit amused. I checked this before I came down here because I wanted to be sure I'm up to date. I looked up in chem abstracts for the six of them. No one's ever made it. It's never been made. It's twice in the literature, reported in the literature, but both because I wrote it as an interesting compound that's never been made in a review article. So it's in the literature because I said it was interesting, but it had never been made. When it came abstract, it never had been made. But it's, if the person who first succeeds in making that has committed a felony. Because it was scheduled. No, it's named as such, right in the law, even though it's never been made. These are humorous parts of the law. They're law of history. Anyway, so six of those, made five of them, and the only ones that interested me were Metzengofsky in the 3-4 position. So my attention is being sucked out to that 3 and 4 position. As it turns out, I'm not going to go into the full detail. Let's go through all the little steps that went on. It'll take probably 4 or 5 hours. If you want to take the time, we need to eat dinner tonight. But anyway, I made a whole lot of those. I began mucking around different ways, different combinations of things. The next general direction I went is I settled on the 2-4-5, which is 2-methoxy, 4-5-methyldoxy, or 2-4-5-trimethoxy. And I made each of the methoxies into an ethoxy. A methoxy is the methyl group of an oxygen. Ethoxy is 2 carbons on an oxygen. So in essence, if you have 2-4-5-trimethoxy, you can have 2-ethoxy-4-5-methoxy, 4-ethoxy, 2,5-dimethoxy, 5-ethoxy-2,4-dimethoxy, 2,4-diethoxy-4-methoxy, 2,5-diethoxy-4-methoxy, or 4,5-diethoxy-2-methoxy, or tetraethoxy, a triethoxy. So I made them all. In the lab, I was done, you might as well go ahead and make them all, which I did. The only one that showed interesting activity was the 4-ethoxy. So this is a little bell that rang. Something about that 4 position has got a little bit of sparkle to it. It's a point where nature, I guess I'm natural, so I'm doing natural things, said this is a point at which I'm going to begin, if I get mutations going on or changes in the way I do things, this is where I'm going to focus a little bit. So I did. I made this 2-4-5-trimethoxy. I said, if the 4 position is so fancy, here's a situation where you can't lose. If you were to take that methoxy, I knew the methoxy came off because I can't keep collecting urines and running analyses and the methoxy group disappears. I'd like to know what happened to it in me, because sometimes you get into things in which the compound doesn't do something, but the compound goes into you and it's changed to something, and what it's changed to is what does things to you. So sometimes the metabolites are the things that are the active ones to pursue. This is a whole other chapter of this talk, which I won't get into. Anyway, so I made, I said to myself, if the 4-methoxy group is the active thing, and it kind of comes off easily, let's say, and becomes a phenol, and if it conjugates with some glucuronic acid or something, gets secreted in the urine. Let's put something on that group that can't come off easily. So I said, why not, instead of a methoxy, put a methyl on there? Now, methyl can't hydrolyze off. It can oxidize to an acid, it can do all kinds of things, but it cannot hydrolyze off. We love sort of an atom. So I put a methyl group in there, and I said, you've got a case here to win. If the compound turns out to light the receptor site somewhere in the brain, there's something to these things go and plug in and do things. If it lights that receptor site, it's going to go to that receptor site. It's going to go into the receptor site, and one of two things. Either it is going to be an active psychedelic, and it's going to be an interesting one because it can't hydrolyze into something that's inactive, so it might be a really potent thing. Or it might go in and be inactive. And if it's inactive, but it goes to the receptor site that psychedelic drugs tickle, and it's inactive, if there's something endogenous in the person that makes the person want you, well, that's the wrong term. Schizophrenia. And schizophrenia. I use the word schizophrenia.
Slow down just a
bit. I have been frequently asked to speak more slowly. And I will do my best to accede to that request. It's good for about 40 seconds. I'll try. If it were to go into the receptor site and block the receptor site from some indigenous factor in there that makes a person schizophrenic, you have a cure for mental illness. You can't lose. It's either going to be a potent psychedelic or it's going to be a for people who are a little bit schizophrenic. Okay. Not schizophrenic. Oh, I gave a grand rounds at Harvard. I use the word schizophrenic psychiatry. It's not a graceful thing to do. And I got chewed up for that after. Schizophrenic is the word I'm sorry. And talk about people who are schizophrenic. And there are, this is an aside. I don't have a time. Who's he's gone? That's a boy, that's a compliment. We had at Donner Labs about 20, 25 years ago, an opportunity to work with schizophrenic patients from Mendocino County when they had a whole lot of them in the mental hospital. Okay. And so I made some S-adenosine methionine, which is a kind of neat derivative of methionine, because they thought at the time methionine is what provokes mental illness in people who are with it in their diet and have a proclivity toward mental illness. It made it more extreme, but those who did not have that proclivity did not have that response to it. And they're using methionine as sort of a titrant for potential schizophrenic illness. And I happened to have some radioactive sulfur knocking around, so I made it with radioactive sulfur. So you put it in there and measure the distribution of it in the brain. You put it in here, you put people in a positron emission to walk the camera, and you put them in there, and we had these five normals, a little tricky to find them in Lawrence's lab, we found them, and five schizophrenics who were simple to get up in Mendocino Hospital, and line them all up, and we gave each of them a separate day, separate circumstances, enough radioactive S-adenosine methionine to see it in the brain. And we ended up with 10 photographs. We put them on the wall of the Lawrence lab up on the hill, and they're pictures of the brain with this radioactive thing in there, and everyone was different. Everyone was different. Some had bright here, some bright there, some lines, some hips, what have you. And every time anyone comes through from the National Institute of Health, coming in from the East Coast, in brain chemistry, what have you, here, 10 brain scans, that's the demonstration of finding, 5 of the normals and 5 of the schizophrenics. Which are the normals? Oh, God, we kept tallies. Random. I mean, no one could pick up which was abnormal because they're all different. And then about 3 months later, one of the schizophrenic patients came in, and Tony, my ally there, who could talk to schizophrenics, was great. They just sort of trusted him for some beautiful reason. And he was in there, and the schizophrenic came in. Yeah, he goes, those are the pictures you took of us. Well, one of each of you. Oh, that's me. He pointed at this photograph, and he's absolutely right. He picked his picture out of 10 pictures that was of his head under S-adenosine methionine. Tony said, how do you know? Simple. See the little star-shaped figure down the lower right-hand corner? The little figure looks like a star there? I see it all the time. So there are a lot of things about brain chemistry we don't understand yet. But that's the kind of thing you keep running into. Things that are apparent and obvious to someone, and suddenly you, with all your sophistication in the world, can't see through it at all. And that's why I love this area of chemistry, because all of a sudden you make a compound that should be a wild psychedelic, and you end up convulsing. Or I made a compound that should be totally inactive and is active, or vice versa. And every time you add a little bit more knowledge of what's in the structure, what goes to making it active, you think you're getting a little closer to the target, you're just very opening new doors in new ways. It's actually a fascinating pursuit. Anyway, back to the lecture. That was a red flag, I noticed right down there. Back to the argument of making synthetics. So I made this compound with a methyl group at that position, which if it came off, we obviously, it couldn't come off. If it blocked the receptor site, then, and the receptor site was triggered by an endogenous psychotogen, then you have indeed have a treatment for illness due to internal psychotomimetic things. And if it is active, you got a new potent. Well, it turned out it was very active. And in fact, the activity left up by a factor of about 4 or 5 fold over anything I'd made before. I called it desoxy, because I took the oxygen away to put the methyl group on it, called desoxymethyl. And then it had the slang name of DOM, which was became quite popular about the 1960s out in San Francisco. In fact, that was quite a chapter in San Francisco. At that time, I was in medical school. I remember wandering down through the hay, actually memorizing the circles of Willis so I could repeat the quiz that afternoon. And all around me, people were stoned on the stuff DOM, but they called it STP. And that was originally, it was, I think, a racing car oil or something. But they had it as serenity, tranquility, and placidity. But no one when Stone could pronounce placidity, and so it came out serenity, tranquility, and peace. And the policemen called it too stupid to puke, and they called it stop the police. It was a lot of slang about that thing, but it was put in tablets and sold as an LSD substitute. The difficulty is the tablets were 20 milligram tablets. The active dose is 5 milligrams. Who had the inspiration of making 20 milligram tablets? I don't know. And it takes a while to come on. Some of these trisubstitute things are quite slow in onset. And people would take one, but then come on, they'll take another one. They're turning into the Haight-Ashbury Clinic with 40 milligrams of the stuff on board, not knowing what it was chemically. They knew I was kind of in the area. They asked me if I knew an STP. I'd never heard of STP in my life, because it was initials I had never heard of. And it was about three or four months before that whole thing, the manufacturer, whoever was making them, cut down the level 10 and finally to 5 milligrams. That time it got a very negative reputation. And indeed, at those levels, it slowly come on. It's a long trip. But from my point of view, I had already discovered activity, turned over to friends of mine at Johns Hopkins, who were doing work, not present crowd, an earlier crowd, doing work there in the area of psychedelics. And one of the ethoxy, I made the ethyl for them. They said, if you can put lovely things on there, don't metabolize. I said, try anything. So I stuck on iodine, stuck on bromine, stuck on a thiol, a methyl thiol, all kinds of other groups in that marvelous four position. And one of the first ones I put on was a bromine. So if this is DOB, that's DOB. The DOM, this is DOB. So made DOB, that was quite an interesting chapter. After 2 or 3 milligrams, you take it, you don't really begin turning on for about 4 or 5, 6 hours. You're into it for the night, you sleep through the night, next day you're still stoned. You are really in for a 36-hour trip. It's quite a time-consuming thing. So we did this up on the hill at the Lawrence Lab. We made the material, probably just down at Berkeley campus. We had access to all the instruments in the world. This is before there were any such things as psychedelic drugs, before any such things as illicit laboratories. And we worked at the Lawrence Lab down there, Lawrence Lab up there. Cyclotron, we could run a cyclotron, we had keys to the cyclotron, we had keys to the gamma counters, we had keys to everything. Because we go in at night and do whatever we want. They object? No, they rather appreciate it. As long as we publish, anything we can do, anything we want. So we made that with the bromine, DOB. Bromine 77 and bromine 82. I think we used both of the gamma-emitting isotopes. The bromine 77 is the one we worked with more. And what we did, we said, if this thing is, let's see what it does in the body. So we made a nice sterile solution and injected intravenously about a fraction of a milligram, because we didn't want to get that stone. We just want to see where it goes in the body. We lay on this gamma bed scanner, and it moves with you lying across this way with a bunch of gamma detectors underneath here. And as you go across with the gamma detectors, as if they were scanning up the body, except the scan, the other way, you go ahead first. And over here is a great big monitor and lines that show what the gamma thing is seeing. They see an outline of the body. Here's the head, here's the hands, here's the body, here's the hip, here's the legs. So you just scan too fast.
Yeah.
And here are the legs. So you scan this thing slowly and you can get time-lapse photography of where it's going through you by taking this picture, then this picture again as a film and show it as time-lapse photography. Beautiful. So we saw this thing going into the body. It got a little messy. It's not very good at intravenous injections. You got a little thing in the tissue around here. It's a little spot over here. You can see the bladder slowly going to the sides of the nasal, the sides of the orange, the sides of the grapefruit, because urine is collecting and the urine is radioactive, so the bladder shows up as being radioactive. And we want to see how much goes to the brain. Almost none. Holy moly, we looked at this more carefully over the period of time, and very little was going to the brain, mostly going to the lung. And so we go in a little longer, and the lung level begins dropping off, and then the brain level starts going up. So a period of the stuff is snagged in the lung. The lung is about the second most potent metabolizing organ in the body, and then it is metabolized as something that carries the radioactive isotope with it, the bromine goes with it, but it's not the starting material, it's a different material. And then the lung goes down, the brain goes up, the person gets turned on, goes sparkle, sparkle, and it takes many hours for it to really drop comfortably down out of the brain. So here we're seeing something in which the active component is not what we thought it was, it's something the body generates from what we gave to the body. No idea what it is. No one's ever pursued it. We've published the whole thing, no one's given a damn, no one's ever looked at it. But it's interesting, DOB, a brain long-lived thing, is extremely long-lived. Because of a metabolic change, and we looked at the urine, chromatographed this, that, never did find out what the radioactive bromine was attached to. These little fun things you do on the side. Meanwhile, we make our own bromine, we know how to turn the cyclotron on, I'll switch over here, focus a little bit, make your isotopes. Ah, that's marvelous. Those are marvelous things. No longer do they have such liberty, I'm afraid. They now want to know what you're going to do and to whom and why. At that time, you could do anything you want, for any reason you wanted, anyone you wanted. It's absolutely marvelous. Good old days. Anyway, so that happened. I put bromine, but I did not DOI. In fact, that's an interesting cut. DOI is equally potent, long-lived. 2 couple milligrams is all you want to ever handle of DOI. And interestingly enough, there's a company in the East Coast, in the Boston area, that makes isotope-labeled or unlabeled materials for neurological testing. They have agonists, various neurotransmitters here and there. And they have both DOB and DOI. They offer DOB requires a DEAVND 222 form and all kinds of communication because it has to be a Schedule One drug. But they never schedule DOI. Equally potent, equally powerful, equally long lived, and they sell it there without any restrictions whatsoever. But once they found it psychedelic, the price went up fivefold, but they're in the business of selling agonists for neurotransmitters. So it's there, but if anyone really has an academic license, they want to get turned on a DOI, you can buy samples from commercial sources, no problem. Anyway, so this is all going on. I still haven't gotten around to it. I'll get around my topic pretty soon, which is new cryptomines, but you have to be patient. I've told I still have 25 minutes. I was told I still have 5 minutes. Okay. Why don't you wiggle your hands and I'm running short of time. So, if all this is going on, what about this minor two-carbamine? That's all with the methyl group hanging down in that alpha position. Take the methyl group off. You're back to phenethylamines again. So I went back to phenethylamines. I found the bromo compound, the iodo compound, the sulfur compound, the alkyl sulfur compound. All these things are fascinating as amphetamines. And I know they'd be less potent as phenethylamines, but what about them? So I synthesized all of those things. And one of them that really caught my fancy was the bromo compound. It's called 2CB. Because 2C, because it only has two carbons, I went from three back to two. And then I named the thing on the fourth position, which is down here somewhere, as what's on there. So 2CB is a bromine in that position, all of 2,5-dimethoxy. Iodine has an iodine there. 2CB is illegal. 2CI is not. Just to keep it in mind, it is of comparable activity. Some people prefer it to the bromo, some people prefer the bromo to the iodine, but I'd make it a 50-50. So keep in the back of mind, 2CI is a fascinating one. The sulfur in that position led to what I call 2CT, T for thio, 2C4, 7 just became scheduled, oh, that's by something, 2CT7, which has been a notorious thing in a lot of publications recently. It was just made as of roughly the first of the last month, a Schedule One drug, and these are proposed for scheduling because of the power of being scheduled. And it's rather an interesting little twist in that they have actually cited, because no one's ever published the chemistry, they had no choice but citing pKal as the method of synthesis, which I found to be interesting in the Federal Register to find a book I wrote being a synthesis citation for a new scheduled drug. That's the way it goes. Sulfur in that position, alkyl in that position, 2CM is the methyl compound, not interesting. It's been used as a more or less almost like a placebo extender of other things. 2CE, the ethyl compound, is a fascinating one. Propyl compounds acting, butyl begins dropping off. These are whole areas that I found to be fascinating, explored a lot of them, but then I caught up in the world of cryptamines. And as you can go any thousands of doors in the hallways of the phenethylamines, that basically they'll get in that hallway, phenethylamines are the hallway over here, there's cryptamines, in which there are thousands of doors, and every door leads to other doors. And so I got off in this cryptamine area. In the cryptamines, there are several that are natural, maybe 5, 6. You have DMT, dimethyltryptamine, and here we have the tryptamine. And I have a chain out here with the nitrogen. So the NN dyes are alkyl groups on the nitrogen over here. And the 4 and the 5 positions are the only places on the cryptamine ring where substitution things. Oh, well, I'm here. Still here. I have here. Yeah. I'll have these. I'll get around to these in about 7 minutes, 8 minutes, whatever. The natural ones, DMT, dimethyltryptamine, in a chapter in the second book that Dan and I wrote, I have a chapter entitled DMT is everywhere, and believe me, it is grasses, it's in leaves, it's in every darn thing under the sun, it's beautifully widely distributed. It's in you, it's in your spinal column, it's in your brain fluids, and so I'm really amused when they have DMT as being Schedule One, and anything that contains it means that everyone in this room is containing a scheduled drug and is subject to the corresponding punishment of becoming a felon with 10 to 20 years in prison if they choose not to like you for other reasons. But these things are in you. These are in your brain system. These are natural things. That's one reason I think the DMT, you can smoke a joint of DMT, get over it, whatever you get, smoke another joint, have another trip, get over it, smoke another joint, have another trip. You don't exhaust yourself because it's a natural compound in you. And your body has a way of handling and taking care of it. So one of the major ones there is a dimethyltryptamine, N and dimethyl on this end, with nothing on the 4 or 5 position. Another one is the 4 position, you put an oxygen. You have then the 4-hydroxy, N,N-dimethyltryptamine, common name is psilocin, which is one of the two words that the DEA consistently misspells. They, for some reason, spell it with a C-Y-N at the end of C-I-N. But they always spell marijuana with an H. Have you ever seen it, federal publications on marijuana? Always an H instead of a J. Why? I don't know. Oh, the whole thing about marijuana and the DEA, this, I'm not even going to talk about marijuana today, but I've already started, so I'm going to talk about marijuana just that little bit. It's a fascinating thing on the old crowd in the DEA, who used to be in the Bureau of Narcotics, called BNBD, which used to be the Bureau of Narcotics, BN. And back in that time, when they made marijuana a scheduled drug, they made it a narcotic, by definition, in 1936, approximately. There were only two narcotics, basically. There were varieties of, but two nuclear narcotics, and that was cocaine and opium, and heroin or morphine and opium. And Anschlinger was the guy who made his career on getting the Bureau of Narcotics, famous and well-known, put it in there, and it was, of course, classified as a narcotic. So legally, marijuana is a narcotic in old federal law, which is fascinating. And there are people in the old crowd still looks upon marijuana as a narcotic, because that's what it was when they came into the thing in the 30s, and it's still there. And so the term, this is sort of an inside joke, but you're welcome to share it if you want. In the DEA, people who still believe that marijuana is a narcotic are called Jurassic Narcs. Not yet retired crowd of people who have this as part of their vocabulary. But that's all been changed with, as Jonathan went into a great deal from that combining to the, what was in the BDAC, the Bureau of Drug Abuse Control, which was run by the FDA. The FDA ran a drug control system there, which is a Department of Agriculture, of course. But the Bureau of Narcotics is run by the Department of Treasury. Nothing to do with health, nothing to do with justice, but Treasury and Agriculture. Then they're combined into BNDD, Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, which went from roughly 1968 to about 1973. And then that was dissolved and became the Bureau of this Drug Enforcement, DEA Drug Enforcement Administration. Anyway, bounce along a little bit more. 4-hydroxy group over on the cryptamine 4 position. Is psilocin, the phosphate ester, and the psilocybin, the two major active components of the mushrooms, which I'm sure some of you have already experimented with from across the street. Psilocybin is the name of the phosphate ester. I've often wondered, curiously, if it's active by itself, or does it have to split down to psilocin to be active? The question was answered about a year ago by some Swiss pharmacologists and physicians who gave psilocybin to some innocent people and found in the blood level psilocin appearing almost immediately. So psilocybin is converted to psilocin in vivo, as a metabolite. And then, of course, there's subversion, there's the semilanciata, what do you call it, one of the baeocysteine in the psilocybe baeocystis. The baeocysteine is the one that has the phosphate group on the 4 position oxygen, but only one methyl group on the amine. There's norbaeocysteine. Its activity has never been established in man. Baeocysteine is active in man, but norbaeocysteine, which has a phosphate group on the 4 position, phosphate oxy on the 4 position, and no methyl groups on the nitrogen, has not been assayed in man. Don't know about it. I had a good friend, Paul, who's a chemistry professor at Ann Arbor, who had done the first isolation of both baeocysteine and norbaeocysteine from psilocybe baeocystis. And I asked him, I would like to run TLC on these if you have reference standards. So I need just 100 micrograms, though, I would need at each of them. So I set up a TLC thing and assay different mushrooms for the composition of these. And said, do you know if it's active or not? He said, I don't know, but I've had some graduate students working around there pretty diligently. They may have suspected one thing or another. So he went to get a few 100 micrograms as a reference sample for me. The vials had totally disappeared. They had gone. He came back with knowledge that I don't have any reference samples left. I suspect the graduate students have found the thing. They may be able to tell you if they're active or not. But at the moment, to this point, no one knows about the activity of norbaeocysteine. I do not know. I've never tried it. And I can't get reference samples from Michigan. Anyway, on the 5 position over here, another natural one is the 5-hydroxy, not 4-methoxy. 4-hydroxy is the psilocin. The 5-hydroxy is, and with the dimethyl group on this end, is known as bufotenine, and it has a fair amount of notoriety, scheduled 1 drug. I have for a long time assumed that bufotenine was not an active compound. The only human studies were done in these marvelous narcotic hospitals, whatever Jonathan called them. They're prisons where you got locked people up and then give them drugs. Narcotics. Prisoner narcotic, prison type hospital experimental places. Really wild. They put people in there. They say, we'd like to try this compound, and we'll try Rifotin. You mind? Sure, it's okay. And you line them up, you inject Rifotin in five people, and they say, well, doc, what do you want to see? We'll know if you see colors. Okay. And they load them up with 16 milligrams each intravenously, and they sure saw colors. And if they report well, they know what's needed to be seen, they were kind of reported in that direction because as a thank you for having put themselves into that jeopardy position for the day, they're giving a pass to the pharmacy and they can get any drug they want. And so they're in there presumed to be treated for drug addiction. And the truth is they have access to the pharmacy by being experimental subjects for any drugs they happen to want anyway. And the pharmacy kept heroin on hand and had a heavy flow of that. This is all kind of quiet. The hospitals don't exist anymore, but for a while they were notorious as being one of the major academic sources of information in the area of action in men. So that is where the Rifotin was first studied, 5-hydroxy-NN-dimethyl. And they got sort of a colored viewing. The face is turned a little bit orange, but you have some of this flush, these are called serotonin flush. You get these things from other things. And I was really skeptical of the materials, and they're really not active. Then a paper would appear from Australia that said, oh, yes, it's active. We found by intravenous administration so-and-so, so much, gave very strong action. Then a paper appeared from Norway saying, we gave that amount of people, had no action at all. And so it just balanced 50-50 of active, not active. The whole thing was that way going. Finally, good friends of mine got it out of a South American pre-Anthra... Sibyl. This is Manolo and Reki. And they took seeds of this and they ground up the seeds, hazed them up a little bit, because they're finding them in these mummy things. They mummies it down there at the high levels that have been intact for years. And they find with the mummies these little snuff crates where they had used the snuff. And they're assaying the snuff trays for residues of plants to know what the snuffs are made out of. And these are, 1,000 years old, maybe?
1,200
years old. And the plant residues are in there intact. And you can tell the quality of the snuff by the quality of the clothes that put on the money. Higher class, better clothes, different snuff. So you began making a sociological study of what classes used what kinds of snuff. And when they're coming up was this Anthanasera. And they made up a seed thing, ground it up, heated a little bit, stored it. I never did you? No. And acting. And yet the GC shows nothing in there but Rifotin. So, okay, I have to back away a little bit. I'll say, okay, I was wrong. It apparently is active. My one case is one of my favorite psychiatrists wanted to snort somebody, took my entire supply up the nose and got nowhere. And so I assumed it was not acting, but then it may have been not an acting psychiatrist. I don't know. Anyway, this is where these are. So what I am now uncovering is the fact that with a hydroxy group in this position, at the 5 position, you have interesting compounds. On the handout. That's the first thing on the handout. I have it on the handout. The upper one are the 5-methoxy, 5-hydroxy, 5-H, 5-hydrogen on the 5 position. And what I have across the top, methyl, H-methyl, ethyl, isopropyl is a methyl, and another methyl stuck on it. Propyl is a 3-carbon chain, allyl is a 3-carbon chain with a double bond in it. And going down this way, then between the two of them, you get the two substituents on that nitrogen. If it's an H, there's only one substituent. If it's an HH, there are no substituents. So in that, by a little bit of thought, you can see what the actual structure is. These are a top one, are all 5 hydrogen, mostly N this and N that substituted. And I've written in there 250 tryptamine itself is kind of a blood pressure changer, not a nice thing. Dimethyltryptamine, I gave an activity level of 60 milligrams of dose. It has to be smoked or taken parenterally. It is not active orally. Some people go to 140. Is with me quite active. I find it, although it was a thing loved by a lot of experimentalists, I happen to find it a dull thing. And primarily, I find myself suddenly lying flat on my back, wondering what the hell I'm doing here. Unable to move, visions everywhere. So what? I just soon start doing something else. And about 30, maybe 40 minutes, I'm able to get around a little bit. So that's why the fountain to me is many people dislike it after they love it. Anyway, let me go down here. The methyl-ethyl, methyl-isopropyl, methyl-propyl. Notice you get larger groups out there. Activity 60 milligrams, 80 milligrams, 20 milligrams, greater than 20 means that ergon higher than 20. The diethyl is a fascinating compound. In the diethyl, over in here, is an active at 100 milligrams, but it's quite poisonous. It just gives you a bad thing. You vomit. You are not comfortable with body. Your body has been poisoned. And I found quite often when you have those two carbons on either, on that nitrogen, and including this horror over here, I have it as pyridyl, piperidine rather, T at 50 milligrams. I've made others, but that's as far as I go. Again, very toxic. And I'll get down to the same thing with the 5-methoxy, see if it's worse down below. But anyway, all the diets are 60, 80, 40 here, 40 there, 250 there, 200 down the bottom, the dialyl. The dialyl tryptamine, that I indicated at 80 milligrams, is an interesting compound. It's published first by Stephen Zahra, who is the head of the research of psycho something or other in NIDA. And I knew him quite well. He was a great experimenter. And he'd always make these compounds up, and he always made them in a casual way. In fact, often he had some technician make the compounds, and the technician was not adept in chemistry, and sometimes what was made had little resemblance of what he thought was made, and sometimes the label on the bottle did not have that much integrity as to what was in the bottle. I found this out because there's a person who I'll not name, who was called a perennial graduate student, who had a PhD from somewhere in Israel, and he spent a year in every laboratory in the world just to learn how they knew and how he could contribute. And he worked for a while in NIDA and did analyses on a lot of these things. SARS, interesting compounds. Many are correct, some are wrong. So it's a little bit of a question mark over in advance. He reported 80, he reported 60, and then in a review reported 100 as being the active level of the dialyl-tryptamine. Top half of the paper, the bottom ALALT. And I actually went to the original paper. He said, he just gave it in a table. In the second paper, he alluded to the first paper as being something we tried, gave no pharmacology at all. And two subsequent papers, he really merely alluded to the second paper and no details, but it's in there. It's in all the review papers as well. The second half of my time still, and
10 more minutes.
10 more minutes, okay, good. I will wind up seeing time for plenty of questions. The second half, the lower half of the table, is all this with the 5-methoxy group on there. And it's laid out in the same general pattern way. So what is up there, you go to the same shape down below and compare it without and with the methoxy group. And suddenly you have 10s and 6s and 2s and 12s and 8s and 16s. Then your activity is up by a factor of about 5. In potency. And again, the diethyl is a really nasty one. The diethyl 5-methoxy and the diethyl tryptamine should be active up around 10 or so milligrams by logic, 10 above it, 12 down below. But at 2 milligrams, my first one is a 3/4 milligram. I was out the back door of the house vomiting. And this is not usual when you smoke something like that. That's oral. When you take something oral like that, it's very quickly vomiting. And then I crossed it up to, I think, 1.25 milligrams. 3 or 4 or 5 days later, vomiting again, and then violent diarrhea. It was a very definitely toxic thing to the body. And the psychedelic level should be around 10 if anything extrapolates with any rational aspect. Nowhere near 10, believe me, because I can't get over 2 without really being a threat. So the diethyl, again, the corresponding piperidine compound, piperidine is 2-ethyl groups attached to the carbon atom. So in essence, you have that same diethyl nature. 2, extremely negative at 2 milligrams orally. So that whole diethyl is a suspect. But the diisopropyl, that would be the one of the IPA on the left and IPA overhead, I have it as 12 milligrams, is the one that's gotten very notorious right now on the internet. The name originally Foxy-Methoxy, or Methoxy-Foxy, I forget which came first. No one knew what a methoxy was, it was just called Foxy. And I think it's still commercially available. It's not illegal. It's one that I was quite interested in because although I found it to be a rather mysterious and not particularly pleasant psychedelic, but real, very, very real, a lot of sound distortion and visual. What I found in subsequent exploring around, that about a third or half the dosage, it had almost no psychedelic action, but its primary value is increased intensity of orgasm. like Viagra will give you the thing sticking out there, but it doesn't do anything on the orgasm intensity. This doesn't do a thing for erection. But once you get to your orgasm, that obviously is a combination of the two. In fact, we had a fellow down at Palenque who worked for Pfizer, I leave his name unmentioned, who was intrigued by the fact that this methoxy anandiester propyltryptamine did enhance orgasm. He made something back in Pfizer that had verified by a quiet male that it worked for him too. And this Pfizer is what makes a Viagra. So he sent a letter to the higher echelons in Pfizer. Here's a combination of drugs that would be a fantastic winner if you can get them together and put them this way. And he sent me quiet, unidentified copies of the two people in higher management who answered him. One of them says, interesting idea, but we don't want to get into it. The other one is, you're out of your skull. So that's not going to come into reality, not too faster anyway. Anyway, so the reason I'm interested in this is for a number of reasons. The very bottom, lower right-hand corner, the dialyl, which I call 5-methoxydalt, is what I just now recently finished running up. Anne and I shared it a few weeks ago. Strange at 16 milligrams, 12 milligrams is active, 8 milligrams is noticeable. Not a psychedelic, this is a psychedelic, but you are in a, my first response is, I was looking at from up here at all the floor and all the furniture from about 10 feet in the air. As if I were 10 feet tall looking down at things. Music, interesting, not a total ally, but then you have to indicate 2-3 carbon chains and double bonds in there are fascinating. So I mean, I'm making vigorously with triple bonds. I call this is the propargyl group, the dipropargyl. I'm making the compound the cyclopropyls. So you have your 3 carbon to form rings. Chemistry is a little tricky in these. I'm making the compound. Oh, a beautiful thing. I made this. How many know what deuterium is? It's like hydrogen, exactly like hydrogen, except it's a little bit heavier and it's a little bit smaller. So I took 5-methoxy and isopropyltryptamine and very carefully made isopropyl iodide bromide. I use the bromide, it is me. Isopropyl bromide with 14 deuteriums. And I put it on the tryptamine. So I have what I call D14, which is diisopropyl 14 deuterium labeled 5-methoxy tryptamine. Who wants to guess if it's going to be more active, same activity, or less active than the compound without 14 deuteriums? More. No votes. Same. Half a dozen. Less. Half a dozen. Because I haven't the foggiest idea. I'm still running up, but these are the fascinating things to answer. Here you have two big isopropyl groups sticking out on this night vision over this way. Two isopropyl groups that are 14 molecular units more massive than the parent compound. The PKA, PKB of the mean is probably off by a couple tenths of a unit, but I don't care about that too much, but you have a bearing on it. But it's a little more snug. The deuterium and alpha deuterium are more snug, they're smaller than the ones with the hydrogen, because that's the way they are. So here's a case where it's either going to be more active, same activity, or less active, but to my knowledge, no one's taken a psychoactive drug, or very few drugs at all, and made all the hydrogens out in the valid part of the molecule into deuteriums. What a fascinating thing. Unanswered. That's exactly where I'm going now. You have the hydrogen, 5-hydrogen up here, the 5-methoxy down there. What I'm very interested in now is the 5-ethoxy. This is going from 1 carbonyl and oxygen to a 2 carbonyl and oxygen. The parent compound is 5-ethoxytryptamine. It has been made and studied in this country, one laboratory, in Russia, in one laboratory, primarily as a protection against radiation poisoning. It has nothing to do with the cycle anything. It has been made there. So I took all and went through the chemical literature to find out how many people have made dimethyl 5-ethoxytryptamine, diethyl, diisopropyl, propyl, allyl, any of these compounds. None of them have been assayed in man. In fact, the parent tryptamine has not been assayed in man. And of all those compounds, not one has even been synthesized. The whole family of dimethyl, diethyl, dipropyl, diisopropyls, what you name it, are not in the literature. They've even been made.
I think Glennon made some of those.
He made the alkyl group.
With 5-ethoxy.
5-ethoxy,
yeah.
But not on the alkyls on there. Hmm? I don't think there are alkyls on the nitrogen, were there?
Yeah, I think there are alkyls on there.
I have I, this literature. I have his writings. Then
I might be wrong, but
I of course pursue it through his name in the literature. But I know he had made a lot of old alkyl, long chain alkyls.
Yeah.
Probe was out to the Butyls. Amyl, I think it went out to the Death Vessel or out to C8 or 9 or 10. I did not realize he had put goodies on the nitrogen.
Yeah.
I'll find out. Okay. He's the kind of work you'd be into. Glennon is in Virginia. Chemist laboratory in Virginia, Britain. Anyway, to me, this may be an exception that I don't think he's an Immelmann, I assure you. These are compounds that are, to a large measure, I think, probably all, but maybe mostly all, not only unexplored, but actually unmade. Here's an actually virgin territory, and it's caught my fancy so much that I've sort of closed in a quiet way some of the cactus thing into abeyance, because I want to get in the laboratory and start looking things on nitrogen, which is kind of where I am, where I'm going now. This kind of picture of where things are and where they're going to go, I'll tell you later when I find out. Any questions? Questions. I'll check the glitter. Questions?
Is deuterium okay to ingest?
Basically, in an organic molecule, it's often casually thought of as not influencing the action of the molecule at all. You take pure deuterated water, heavy water, B2O, and you start guzzling down much of that, you're not going to live long. Because it gets in the way of the kinetics of a lot of body chemistry. You take pure deuterium oxide, heavy water, and feed it to plants, the plants die. But up to about a certain percentage of different plants and different animals, you can go with deuterated water and get away with it. The number pops into mind, something like 50 or 60% heavy water allows you to let the animal or plant survive. But that is at a very vital, very high concentration. In a molecule, deuterium is actually doing a lot of work with nicotine metabolites. For example, a problem. How does a person who is a chronic smoker metabolize nicotine? Well, you've got to get nicotine into him. How do you get the nicotine into him? You can see, because he's using nicotine anyway. He's a smoker all the time. But you want to see how he handles it. You can't give him nicotine because he's taking nicotine all the time. So you put 3 deuteriums on nicotine or 4 deuteriums on nicotine, give it as a patch with that or an injection with that especially, and with all the nicotine all the time in the body, you can see this deuterated thing come out there and drop off. So you begin getting metabolism of deuterated nicotine in a smoker, and we compare it with the metabolism of deuterated nicotine in a non-smoker. It gives a very small amount. You don't get a nicotine effect, yet we've got permission from the university to do this kind of work in normal people. And to a large measure, it does not influence the action of the drug. To a large measure. Within our accuracy, there's no effects there. The area of deuterate, that means all the hydrogens possible going into deuterium, is a virtually unstudied area. Yes?
You mentioned a few of these that are positively psychoactive and still legal. What can I say about
this? Let me know what you find in interest. Yeah. Be cautious. Remember, if you buy them as psychoactive materials that have accidents similar to, or substantially similar to, a Schedule I drug, then you are indeed violating a basic rule of the analog bill, and they may be legal to buy if you want to see if they make petunias turn from red to green blossoms. But taken in you to emulate the action of a scheduled run is a crime. It can be charged as a crime, and a jury may find you guilty of one. Good. Thank you very much.
I guess I should have probably warned you that during his talk, Sasha was referring to some handouts with drawings of the molecules he was describing. And of course, that's what made it possible for him to go so fast a few times. But you've got to admit that a few of those speed talking sections were really music to your ears, weren't they? And by the way, if anyone happens to have a copy of those handouts and can scan them and send them to me, I'll be happy to post them on the Shulgin's page on our Palenque Norte site. So that'd be great to get out there if somebody has one or two copies still hanging around somewhere. So, I hope you weren't planning on hearing a definitive answer on that great debate about natural versus synthetics. You know, I know that Sasha mentioned the topic a few times, but I can't say I'm any more clear on the subject than I was before. Personally, I take the safe bet side of that issue, and even though the psychoactive molecules are the same either way, I'm keeping my bet on the natural side simply because, as you already know, there's always the possibility that in addition to the known psychoactive substances, there could also be some other chemical presence that maybe combine and synergize the main ingredient to give you a little bit more bang for the buck. Who knows? And didn't you find it interesting that in many cases it was only after the compound had been synthesized in a laboratory that it's discovered later in nature? You know, I've heard rumors that even our beloved MDMA appears to have a natural counterpart somewhere out there growing wildly. Now that you've heard what goes into designing a substance that just might be psychoactive, and you chemists, of course, can also appreciate the steps required to synthesize a new compound, well, stop for just a minute and think about the last and I think most important step in this whole process, and that's the human testing step. Not only did Sasha create those 200 plus compounds he talks about in his books, he also tested them on himself. Now here, I believe, is at least for me, the most important part of Sasha's story. He always began with extremely small amounts, and then, if he didn't get a tingle of some kind, he would still only increase the dose a really small amount on the next trial, which would be, you know, days later. Caution, extreme caution, I think, is probably why Sasha Shulgin has lived at such a ripe old age. And I hope he is an example to those of you out there who might be inclined to always begin testing something new, at least new to you, by starting at the high end of the suggested dose scale. And of course, you know, if you don't know the recommended dose on something, go to T-Call. I don't need to tell you how to synthesize and have experience reports, but it also has the dosage recommendations. So don't try to be a hero, you know. Taking overly high doses doesn't make you a hero in my book. It's really pretty foolish, you know. So be careful out there. We need each and every one of you. Besides, you don't want to miss all the fun that's coming on down the pike at us, do you? Well, I guess I better quit chattering here and let you go for now. If you're looking to buy a copy of P-Call or T-Call or both, I think it'd be very cool of you to buy it directly from the Shulgin's Publishing Company, which is Transform Press at Post Office Box 13675 in Berkeley, California, 94712. And I have to admit, I forgot to ask Ann and Sasha what they're charging for a copy of their books these days. And so I'll send them an email and find out, and I'll post it on our webpage on the Matrix Master site as soon as I know. So you can get to that Shulgin page through the podcast, as you know. And, of course, you can also get a copy of their books at Amazon and in most bookstores. Well, thank you, Sasha, for letting us podcast this talk and for everything you've done for all of us. You know, saying thank you just isn't even close to expressing how the tribe feels about you and Anne. So thank you both for everything. And a great big thank you to John Hanna, who produced all these Mind States conferences, and of course to Kevin Whitesides for the recording. Jacques Cordell and Wells of Chateau Hayuk, thanks as always, of course, for the use of your music here in the Psychedelic Salon. And I want to thank each and every one of you out there for joining us here in the Psychedelic Salon. For now, this is Lorenzo signing off from Cyberdelic Space. Be well, my friends.